What you said?
What you said? I'll stay where I am.
Oh, good. All right.
Oh, man.
What's wrong?
A little dirty underwear. I had that on.
All right. You ready?
As ready as I'm going to be.
Hi.
Hi.
This is a very special edition of Working the Rinardi edition with Sandy. Sandy has been doing all the interviews, but today I will be doing an interview of Sandy. So we'll start out with Sandy, can you tell me what your current title is and where you're employed?
Yes, I work for the University of Wisconsin Foundation, and my current title is Managing Director of Gift and Constituent Records.
How long have you been there?
2 years this week.
What's a typical day like?
So my day starts before I get to work. Especially right now, I don't have an actual assigned desk at work. So once I go get to the office, I move around from place to place or find a spot that's either a desk that's not being used or a table somewhere or in a little cafe space that we have. So often I start working before I get to work. I will do answer emails, or if there's projects, I'll do some meeting preparation in the morning. I'll get up around between 5 and 6 and do an hour or two of work before I get there. And then once I get to work, at 9 o'clock every day, I have a Q&A meeting with one of my teams, the team that does all of the entry of donations and pledge commitments, long-term commitments to give money over a period of years. The team that manages that, we have a Q&A meeting every morning from 9 to 9:30, where all the random scenarios that come up as they're going through their work, we field those questions and answer them. We look through questions they're receiving, some help desk tickets that they might get, and talk through how to deal with all of those. Then after that, I will have, depends on the day, but I typically spend a lot of my day in meetings. I have 5 direct reports, and two of them I meet with every week for a one-on-one for an hour at one point. Two others I meet with every other week, and then the third one I meet with very rarely. But I have one-on-one meetings with them. I have one-on-one meetings with my boss just to talk about all of the various things that are going on, all the projects, whatever kind of support or things need to get done, questions answered, etc. And then I sometimes have meetings with my teams to discuss initiatives that we have. We have a lot of new processes that we need to implement, new things that our coworkers need to do that we need to support. So I meet with them. Then I have a whole range of meetings with all other departments in the foundation, often with our technical team who might be building customizations for our software. And because my team does a lot of data capture, of entering data on people and gift information, many, many other projects in the organization that are going on require input from our team to understand how that works. So I have a lot of meetings like that. Then I sometimes have work on policy meetings with our finance team to talk about how we're managing our financials, or policy meetings with the fundraising teams and workflow to figure out how we can do things more efficiently. So that's a lot of it. Sometimes I also have things that branch out into working with people on campus who don't actually work for us, but work with us and send information our way for fundraising. So I spend a lot of my time in meetings. Time that I'm not in meetings is sometimes it's doing actual data entry. Sometimes it's doing a lot of planning and documenting of stuff for the future.
So you touched on it a lot in your description of your day, but can you talk a little about what your role and responsibility is? So what your department does?
Yeah. So I have three teams of people that report to me, a team that's dedicated to managing data on constituents, so alumni and donors and other people, that they capture, you know, basic information, name, address, certain interests, mailing preferences. How do people want their names to be addressed on envelopes? How do, what types of things might they want to get or not get, things that they've opted out of receiving communications from us. Then I have a team of people who manages gift entry and pledge entry. And that is a much more complicated task, a part of our organization than I think a lot of people realize. We have a very high number of high dollar commitments from donors. Donors giving at the low end $25,000 on up to commitments of $50 million at a time, $100 million at a time. And those commitments often have complex payment plans and rules about how they're going to pay and where the money's going to come from and how it should be allocated and spent and ways that we have to record it so that our finance team can spend it accordingly. And so that team has a pretty, they have kind of a complicated job, but we tend to staff it as more of a data entry position. And so it's a little bit tricky because they're trying to get, trying to increase awareness for what it really requires and what kind of skills are really needed to do the job over time. And then I have a final team which does scanning of paper documents or retention. We use a system that organizes and files all kinds of documents that we keep. And then we've got retention rules for how long we keep them before we purge them. Things like agreements to make a pledge when a donor says they'll give us however much money they're going to give. It says what they want it to be spent on and how long, how they, what installments they plan to use to pay it. And then there are things called memorandums of understanding and fund operating agreements. When donors establish their own funds, they say, I'm going to set up a scholarship fund that will be used to fund scholarships for students of a certain background or from a certain location, et cetera. And they put some guidelines in it. And then those are usually 6 to 10 page legal contracts for everything around how it's going to be set up and what will happen with the money if it doesn't get spent and all this other stuff. So we have a team that takes care of managing all the documents and how we're going to keep those. So my role is those teams do those activities, but as the director of those teams, I both oversee them and their operations on a day-to-day basis, and I work with many other departments to improve the ways that information flows through the organization to make sure it's clear and timely and that the team gets what they need to record it appropriately. And I work with, as I said a little bit before, technical teams and the reporting teams that write reports and develop reporting and analysis. I work with them to provide subject matter expertise on how the data is recorded and what kinds of crazy scenarios might throw off a standard report or a standard expectation. So you get a lot of exceptions that you have to deal with. And people don't know that unless they're kind of more get into it. So it's my role to help make sure that people understand where those things are and what they need to be aware of when they're building out other tools.
What are some of the different types of gifts that the foundation gets?
We get gifts of, there's a few different ways to answer that question. One is we get gifts of money that are unrestricted, that are basically operating support for the different departments in the different areas on campus. The foundation, we manage the funds for, our role is to raise funds and engage people in order to, for the university and for the UW hospitals and the Children's Hospital and the Cancer Center. So there's a number of entities surrounding within the UW network that we raise money for. So all money that we raise goes back to those entities. The kinds of gifts we get, some are operating support, unrestricted. That means they can be spent however, if it's a departmental, they're typically called annual funds. If you have like the political science annual fund, that means the chair of the political science department can spend that money to support different programs that they want to do or implement. A lot of times it's programming. It might be research, but that's a little bit different. And it might be to fund certain positions, clerical or assistant positions, things like that, where they don't have, it basically offsets money that they're not, to do things that they don't have enough money to do just through state funding and tuition. That's general operating support. Then there are restricted support where people give money for very specific things, and our fundraisers work very hard with donors to align what the departments need to do and want to do from a strategic standpoint and from a standpoint of wanting to be a viable and competitive university. There's things that they want to do, and our fundraisers work with donors to align what the donors want to fund with what those priorities are. Sometimes you get donors who really want to give wacky things that nobody has any interest in actually doing. So those are called restricted gifts, where they're more restricted for how you use them. And then there are another thing, which is permanently restricted money, which means it goes into an endowment fund, and that money can't be spent. We can only spend the interest that's earned off of the endowment. You can't spend the money. And the idea is that you put money into these endowments to continue to earn and spend off of the earnings and dividends from it, so that you are permanently keeping a stable source, and you don't dig into those endowments. You have to do a lot legally to free up that money, to liquidate money in the endowment, and that's something you only do in very dire situations. The funding purpose of endowments is to establish an entity and have it set up so that it can be funded into perpetuity. So that's one way of saying which kinds of gifts we get. The other is all the different ways that people make their payments. There are money that people give just straight cash. They might send checks or credit card information in response to mail devices that we send, mailings that we send out and ask for money. They may give online through our websites. They may give stocks. Stock gifts are pretty common. People give their stocks to us and we sell them immediately. That's the general practice. And then we take the proceeds from the sale, and that's what goes into wherever the donor wanted the money to go. There may be in-kind, anything from somebody donating a cheese basket for an event to be part of a raffle as part of a fundraising event, to there's lots of equipment for our agriculture and life sciences school and college. They get lots of equipment leased for agricultural activities and research and the dairy stuff, a lot of various bovine related materials that get donated from the manufacturers who make them, to also property. Sometimes people will give us a house that we end up selling, or a plot of land and stuff. And those are very, those can be very touchy, because they usually are more work for us than they're worth. And then there's a whole part of fundraising, of giving, which is planned giving, which is giving either saying, I will leave you, I've made an allotment for this organization in my will, to people can set up life insurance policies where we become the beneficiary. And so we may own the policy, they pay us, we pay the premiums, and then when they die, we get the benefit from it. So there's all kinds of a whole range of financial vehicles for under the term of planned giving that are also given.
What about matches?
So there are also things, two different kinds of match money. One is corporate employer matches. So people give money and they tell their company that they gave the money, and the company will then match that gift at whatever ratio they their policies are. Some do half, some do the same amount, some do two or three times the amount that you gave. So individuals send us their gift. Some of them will send it to us with a piece of paper from their company, a form that we fill out. We send it back to the company saying, yes, we got the gift. This is what it was. And then the company sends us the money. Other situations are they have these online portals where the donor goes online and gives a gift, and we get a notification that they gave a gift, and we have to confirm it in their company's website and say, yes, we got it, and then they release the money later. And then others are end up through payroll deductions where they give through some kind of company, and the company takes it out of their paycheck and gives a matching donation at the same amount. And all of these are can be a real they're very painful because the companies don't the companies, I don't know that many companies actually, you know, really love doing this. They do it partly as a most often I think they do it as a corporate morale, and they do it to support and tell both their customers and their employees that we're doing something good, that we're taking doing this is part of our social responsibility aspect of our company, trying to be good corporate citizens. But I don't know that they I don't know. They get some tax benefit from the donations that they give, but I suspect that a lot of times it's not so large that it's really that they would do it if it weren't also for the publicity side of it. So in the end, as long as they can say that they have a program, they're kind of getting their what they need and want out of it. The logistics of these programs are terrible for the organizations because the companies don't put a lot of investment into it. And there are some third-party companies that they use to manage these processes. And those companies have kind of jumped on this as a revenue revenue stream for them. These companies, they sell to the corporations that are going to do the matching gifts. And they say, hey, we'll set this all up. You won't have to do anything. We just take a cut. We take the processing fees from the credit cards, or we take X, Y, and Z, and you don't have to worry about it. We just get your employees this website that they can log into. Well, in that case, the companies are their customers. And to the extent that the company doesn't have to deal with it, then they're satisfied. The employees will struggle. Sometimes they'll struggle to use them. Sometimes the employee experience is great. The nonprofit experience on the receiving end is often pretty terrible because we are the last ones on the priority list. And so we manage a set of over 250 separate accounts, usernames and passwords for different companies. And each one of those is a kind of, they're different. They're not all the same once you start using them. And so you have to learn the different way to get through it. And matching gifts are a little bit of a blessing and a curse, and they really get under my skin sometimes. They're a little crazy making. There's a second kind of match that we deal with a lot right now at the foundation. We're in a comprehensive campaign, which means we're using a lot of publicity to raise money to support certain priorities for the university right now. And you set a goal and you kind of just do a lot of communication about it, but all money that we raise during this time period counts. And so it's a 7-year campaign with a goal of $7 billion. We are 3 years into the seven, and we just hit our halfway point last week, which is not unusual to be that far ahead because you start campaigns with a silent phase. You don't tell anybody you're doing it, but you're quietly working with your biggest donors to give lead gifts so that by the time you actually make the campaign public, you already have your strong footing, and you say, we've already raised this much and here's what we're going for, and it's supposed to create and generate a lot of buzz and energy. And I'm not really sure. The whole thing's a little bit odd to me, but that's how everybody does it. So in our current campaign, there's a trend of doing individual matching gifts, and these are significantly large matches. We had our first one was a $100 million gift from donors John and Tasha Morgridge, who established, they said they would give $100 million in matching for people who would set up faculty professorships and chairs and distinguished chairs. And those, so in those cases, donors had to give money at a, I think it was $500,000, $1 million, and $1.5 million mark. And the mortgages would match that. So donors who made commitments of at least that much to match it toward establishing a chair, a faculty chair, or a faculty professorship, et cetera. So that money goes into the endowment, and it's pre-calculated to figure out how much do you need in order to earn the interest to fund a faculty position for each year, or to just keep the funding going. And so it's a really interesting fundraising mechanism, because it gets people respond well, saying, if I give this much, I can double that impact by having the mortgages match my money. So maybe I don't want to give all $3 million that it takes to establish a distinguished chair, but I can give 1.5 and they'll give the other 1.5, and together we can establish this this position to help the university. And that's actually pretty amazing. In my job, the whole thing is a real pain, but it's pretty amazing to think that $100 million, well, $200 million in the end, we raised it in, I think, 7 or 8 months. That's a lot of money to invest to be able to turn around and establish all of these faculty positions on campus to help keep things competitive and to ensure that the university remains a really great university. So anyway, but for us, it's a pain because we have to track. People come up with a lot of creative ways to do this, and we have to track, find ways to track how much has been received at any given time, how much is available for matching, so that fundraisers know that they have to stop asking people, or if they've got conversations already going with a donor, they have to say, hey, you need to make your commitment fast because the $100 million is almost gone. There's often different categories too for how many, how much is going to be matched in each category. So it's a lot of calculations that need to be managed, and a lot of guidelines that need to be checked when people are making these commitments, and how that's working. We've got two other ones already going on. That one happened, started a year and a half ago and completed in about 7 or 8 months. We're almost done with a second one, which is called a Nicholas match. And this one's dedicated to scholarships. It's $50 million in matching funds for scholarships. Then there's another one for scholarships that's happening right now, a $10 million one. And the interesting thing about the $10 million one is that so far, there are guidelines for what these gifts are supposed to, how they're supposed to be structured in order to qualify. And so far, of the 4 or 5 commitments that they've gotten, every single one of them is considered an exception to the guidelines. None of the ones so far that have been committed actually meet the guidelines, which is making it very difficult on our end to try to track things and measure them to tell them how much money at any given time is accounted for or not. So that's.
How many gifts would the foundation get in a typical year, and how much are those gifts worth? So what's a typical year look like?
So we also, the way that we count in some ways, so the figures that I'm most familiar with off the top of my head are that we count pledges or outright gifts is how they call them. So a pledge might be a multi-year pledge. I'm going to give you $500,000 over the next 5 years. But we would count that 500 this year, even if we haven't received the money yet. So we would not count the payments in future years. Those wouldn't be counted as part of our funds raised that year. And then outright gifts are gifts that did not have any prior commitment. They just come in and count. So the money counts. So you combine those two to get your total funds raised. We typically raise between $300 and $400 million for the last few years. That's what we've raised in a year. Last year, I think it was actually five, and that was the year that had the bulk of this mortgage match money in it. So that's what's raised. Cash in the door, I just ran this recently, and I think we had $400 million in cash in the door last year. And that would mean, but that's a combination of payments on prior year pledges and last year's payments, new payments. So somewhere between $300 and $500 million, depending on which way you're counting this. And that is spread across last year. In my team, we did about 117,000 transactions that was spread across.
Wow. That's certainly a lot of transactions and a lot of money. What are your least favorite things about your job? And you, please try to be brief.
I think my least favorite things about my job are something that I don't know. It's partly my job and it's partly me, because I've seen this in myself in other jobs. And it's that I struggle with wanting things to be a lot cleaner than they are. I wish that different departments could get on the same page and work in sync better than we do. And I don't know that we do any worse of a job than other organizations or companies of our size. We're probably about in the middle in terms of how that stuff works. But I struggle with, we can never seem to get the timing right for having the right resources available at the right time. And unfortunately in my job, because our work is interlaced with so many other departments and other areas, that when other people have projects that they're working on, if it's time for them to work on their project and they need input from me, I don't get a lot of leeway in saying, I don't have time to give you that input right now. We're working on that with my boss and her boss. But it's tricky because we have a really hard time getting that hammered out, coordinating resources across the entire organization. And I think that that's true in many places. I think it bothers me more than it bothers most people. And it makes me makes me frustrated on a daily basis, but on kind of a deeper basis as well, because I'm idealistic about it and just wish it were different.
What are some of the best things about your job?
This is a little obnoxious, but the thing that I like the most about my current job is that I know what I'm doing. In some ways, I am at the top of my game for career-wise. I've been doing my preparation for this particular role probably couldn't have been better. Working as a consultant with, a couple hundred organizations over the prior 10 years really exposed me to all ranges of work that happens within our organization. So I know a lot about the different areas. I know a lot about what my team needs to do, and I know a lot about what other teams need to do. And I'm enjoying that. I'm enjoying not being in a position of having to figure something out. As a consultant, a lot of times you had to figure things out. You were hired as an expert, and you may not have been an expert already, so you're figuring it out as you go, and that's a lot of pressure. But having done that for a long time, I did learn a lot. I got a lot from it, and now I get to use that a lot, and I enjoy knowing that I know what I'm doing and having the confidence to make recommendations and stand by them and not be afraid that they're not right or that I'm missing something all the time. And I do miss things, but I have the confidence right now that that even if I'm missing something, that's okay, and that's merely human at this point and not a reflection on my qualifications.
What are some things at work that would surprise people who don't see you in that context?
That's an interesting question. I think
it's your question, so
I know. And now that you're asking it, or the way that you phrased it is interesting. Well, actually, I'll answer this in a little bit different way, because I think the reverse is true as well. So recently, I'm about to change downshift in my job to go to a part-time position in order to spend more time writing and working on creative writing. And since that has been announced at work, and my boss didn't want people to think that it wasn't my choice, she didn't want people to think that I was being demoted. And so when she made an announcement in our, you know, through our intranet communication, she made it very clear that I was doing this to write and that I had got my MFA and stuff like that. And a lot of people have come up to me and they're just in shock because they think of me as being a data person and as being a systems person. And they say, I can't believe you're a writer. Like, those are two such totally different different ways of thinking and types of work. And so I think that in some ways that might be the reverse, that I think some people might be surprised that know me from outside of work might be surprised at the level of technical knowledge that I have. And they might be surprised, they may or may not be surprised with the level of directiveness that I sometimes take, which may at times even come across as being, nobody's ever said this. I don't know if people find me abrasive or not, but I'm pretty direct, and I'm pretty, I can be a little tough, on things and on the way that I think that things should work. And I'm not sure whether or not that would surprise people who know me outside of there. It would depend on how well they know me, I guess.
I just wanted to make a point of clarification. You didn't actually write any of the questions for this particular interview, but I am stealing your notebook where you have your questions and using that as a guide. So I don't want anybody to think that Sandy had an opportunity to think too hard about what I was going to ask her. Talk a little about your transition, your upcoming transition in your job.
Yep. The last 2 years of my job, I was hired 2 years ago, right before the launch of a major, major, major systems implementation. And one of my departments, within my team, I had both a department that was the most ready for that change and the department that was the least ready for that change. And I wasn't there during the 3 years leading up to it, where all of the work was done. And one of my departments had really was probably only a third of the way ready. And so after going live with the system implementation things, it was crazy. It's been 2 years of crazy, of trying to keep building, flying the ship. No, you fly planes. Flying the plane while you're building it. But I mix that metaphor there because in some ways my job for the last couple of years has been what I think, Keith, you've described before as bailing water out of a boat. And so I think I've been bailing water out of a boat while trying to plug the holes at the same time and trying to get it stabilized. And we've done okay. We've made progress. It sometimes still feels like there's a ton to do, but we've made progress in the team is stabilizing and they're in a spot now to grow and stuff, but it was really exhausting and it was way more work than I had bargained for at that time. I was still finishing my grad school. The job just came up at a certain time and it was the time that they needed me to start. I had one semester left in grad school. So I did both and thought that it would level off, and it just didn't. I straight through until, you know, well, still, as I mentioned, I get up in the morning and work an hour or two sometimes before I even go to work. And there's just no brain energy left. I haven't written anything since October, I don't think, really. And I just don't have the brain power. So it's something that I really, really want to do and want to, I've wanted to do it for a long time. I've worked at it for a long time. And so I want to make this commitment. And I told my bosses that I wanted to, that I couldn't continue the way that we are. And they said, we really want you to stay. And so we figured out a compromise and a role that I'm going to take. So I'm handing over my management duties. The management of the team will go to a new person that we hired. And I'm going to instead focus on just continuing some of the projects that we identified that need to be done for this team that's still stabilizing. So I'm going to focus there. If we get those things done, it's an indefinite commitment. I'm half-time. And I think the title they came up with is, I think it's a project manager of sorts. We'll see if we get some of these projects done. There's an endless range of other ones in the future within the department, and we'll see where it goes. But I'm really looking forward to being able to step back and devote this energy to writing, which I think makes me a better person in general. I'm nicer and calmer.
I'm a big fan of that. What are some things from your own family background that have influenced you at work?
I think that I think one thing is, and I have the benefit of being the last of these interviews, that one thing I think that I can say that I think a lot of us have in common is that we have a very low tolerance for bullshit. Like, we just, across the board, I don't think we deal well with it. I think that there are people who are much better, I guess, are better at just sucking it up and saying, like, oh, that's just part of it. And you go to work and you get your paycheck and you do what you do the best you can, and you move along. And I think that both myself and my siblings are, I think we struggle with that. I think we all have a little bit of that idealism and can be, I think for myself, that sometimes may come across as being a little bit self-righteous or aloof. I don't know for sure. But I think that mom and dad are people who are very committed and grounded in living according to principle and according to doing things that are the right thing to do and to doing them the right way. They have, you know, dad has some strong opinions at times, which we all, I think, do about how we think something should happen. Mom has an incredible way of looking at, I mean, just the way that she managed the household of how, like, why would you do this before would you do, you did this, or doing the right thing, taking care of things ahead of time to prolong and make their, make them last longer, basically doing things right the first time so that you don't have to redo it later and you don't have to do other things. I think that, that there's a lot of that in mom. And I think I definitely carry that into my work, sometimes to a point that's, you know, leads to my own dissatisfaction. But I also think that's okay. I think it keeps me moving and looking for things and trying to make sure that I'm spending my time and living my life in a way that is fulfilling, or that I can feel proud of at the end. And then I think also we were raised, and I don't know how exactly, it's not like they told us this in flat terms, but by their example and by the all of the things that they did sort of teach us or that were expected of us, I think we are raised to know that we have a lot, we've been given a lot, and we should that we should make the most of it. And if you have the capacity to do something, you should do it. And I guess I mean that in a way, like if it's, if I have the ability, if I know that there's something that I could improve on or that I could be helpful in contributing, I should do that at work. I should, I don't know, speak up and fix it. But anyway, definitely not good enough to phone it in, and you should do what we're capable of. We've been very fortunate and given a lot, and we should respond accordingly.
So yeah, you had mentioned obviously that this is the last interview of the Renardi kids. What are some of the things that were most notable to you in the other interviews? Some of the things that you were surprised by or learned or appreciated more?
Well, I appreciated all of it. I appreciated the time that everybody gave and was willing to share and to talk about themselves. I appreciated seeing some of the similarities across the board in what drives everybody and in their take on things. I was very proud of everyone and proud to be part of this clan. The other thing I really loved was seeing people open up and talk about their work as with a certain sense of authority and ownership or pride at times, and just seeing, having time to talk about something focused about them that we don't necessarily always talk about in our day-to-day lives, and to see everybody's areas of expertise and all that kind of stuff. Like it was a really enjoyable.
I absolutely agree. Having been there for them and listened to all of them, it's been pretty amazing. You know, this is one of my favorite questions. What do you do for lunch?
Ironically, when I worked from home, I often used to have so much going on, being so stuck to my computer or my phone, that I could go all afternoon and not having, you know, be running down to the kitchen to grab like a piece of cheese or crackers or whatever at 3 or 4 in the afternoon. And I don't do that now. I never miss lunch anymore. I'm also a little bit notorious. One of my coworkers said, yeah, you are kind of a grazer, because I am unapologetic about bringing food to almost any meeting. I have to if I'm hungry. So I often pack my lunch and will eat it usually at my desk or at my computer, wherever that might be, between noon and one, if I don't have a meeting from noon to one. If I do, then I'll either bring it with or bring it to my next meeting or wherever. So I often will pack my lunch, and just a compilation of whatever. Last week, several times I had a bowl of arugula with lemon juice and a cheese and nut snack thingy and some yogurt and strawberries or whatever. So random whatever I compile from the house or leftovers. And sometimes I will go to Panera and grab my lunch there. I like Panera because they have rapid pickup, so you order online, and then when you get there, it's sitting on a shelf with your name on it, and you don't have to talk to anybody, and it's quick and easy and fast and yummy. And then sometimes if I'm in a pinch or I'm feeling particularly annoyed and just want to eat my frustration, I will get a BLT from Jimmy John's, because they deliver freaky fast. So I order it, and it's often in our lobby within 5 or 10 minutes.
That's freaky fast indeed. What are some of your past jobs? And we've been asking people, obviously, what are their past jobs that they've done?
Mm-hmm. Okay. Well, my first paid jobs outside the house were babysitting for neighbors. Started with when I was maybe between 8th and 9th grade, or 9th and 10th, I don't remember. But for Jared Steinert first, the little guy, so cute, across the street. And then the neighbors next to them, the Haltmans, did that for a couple years till I handed it off to Emmy and Susie. And then my first official sign a W-2, W-4, whatever that document is, it gets you taxes, was Cousins Subs. And I worked there through high school. And then during the college years, there's a whole string of things. I worked all of the summers, I think I had multiple jobs. But I worked when I got to college. Let's see, how did this work? So I worked at Cousins and I worked at Cops in the bakery one summer. And I worked in in college, I worked first. I did had a job in the sociology department transcribing interviews. Interestingly, they were interviews of United Way executives and other funders, community funders. And I learned a lot listening to those interviews by the researcher that did them about how this works in philanthropy. And so that's something that I've kind of carried with me throughout my career, even though it was just the only kind of job I was able to get that first year in college. Then I worked, what else did I work? I worked at specialty packaging or Kakana packaging or something like that. One summer where they compiled calendars and paper items and things where you could put the Far Side calendars together, stuff like that. Did that, talked about Cops, Cousins. Oh, the Holiday Inn in Appleton. I worked at the restaurant there. That was a terrible job. I worked in Chicago at a restaurant called Mighty Nice as a hostess. I worked for a children's consignment shop, a high-end consignment shop.
Did they sell children?
They did not. They did not sell children. But I actually still have clothes. At that time, I could fit into the largest of the children's clothes. And I do still have one dress that I got there. Assignment shop. I worked at a barbecue place, not super long, but for a little while in the summer in Chicago, where I waited on Ben or Jerry. I think it was Ben of Ben and Jerry's once. That was also a terrible job. I worked at the daycare center at Loyola. I worked for Place Inspiration Corporation, or it was Cafe then, with meal program for homeless people, which was very instrumental in forming the rest of my career as well. I worked for, let's see, so I did that. I was hired for a Mexican restaurant and at the end of my junior year in college, and they had it's one of these places that had 100 different kinds of tequila or something. And I was hired and I was very excited because it was finally going to be a job at a restaurant where I would make money, because I always had crappy restaurant jobs. But I ended up quitting before I even started because I had to memorize the tequila list at the same time that I had to take my finals. And I had a breakdown because I couldn't do both of those things. So I ended up not actually, I was hired and then didn't actually end up taking the job. And I kind of regret that for multiple reasons. It would have been nice to know all that stuff about tequila. But so let's see. I did that stuff. I worked for one summer. I worked for our neighbor, Bob Fisher, owned a frozen pizza company, and I did some stuff in their office. And let's see. In Cousins, I kept going back to Cousins forever and managed there at some point too. Then I moved to Baltimore, where I worked as a caseworker, more or less, with kids on probation. Then I went to Boston for grad school, and there I worked for a professor. I can't remember what I did for her, but I worked for a professor. And then eventually I worked for a restaurant there also, and that had 300 kinds of beer, but I didn't have to memorize them. Then I was a nanny in Boston. Oh, and I worked for a little while at a social club, a high-end, fancy-dancy social club in Boston where a lot of my grad school friends, because you could just pick up shifts when they needed it. So when they had private parties, they would have us there to serve food, and we wore what really looked like French maids uniforms with all of the Boston elite. That was fun. It was interesting, and it was also really miserable. Boston, then I nannied. I moved in with a family to nanny, and I don't remember if I even got paid for that or if I just got the housing. That's interesting. But I worked at City Year, where I worked. This one is where I got my start into the technical and the data systems, and where I met the firm that I worked for at Heller Consulting. So a City Year, I did database stuff for them and had to learn it very much on the fly. And then we hired Heller Consulting, who then hired me. And then that was where I spent the bulk of my career so far, with phenomenal people consulting. And then when I went to grad school, I needed to downshift from Heller, and I took a job working from home for another company that does web design for nonprofits called Jackson River. And then I came here to UW.
Wow. Thank you so much.
Thank you.